You're listening to Greater LA. It's KCRW's show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Jared Hill, in for Steve Chiotakis. Terrence Brown is the first one to get here. A vacant parking lot near the beach in Santa Barbara, across from the City College football stadium. He's not here to play football. He's got his roller skates on, ready for the skate meetup.
I started it 3 months ago, and I started skating in general 5 months ago. And I'm so surprised. I'm still shocked today. You know, as today, every time I wake up, I'm like, wow, I started a roller skating club.
Brown didn't even know how to roller skate in March. Now, he organizes a free weekly skate club on Sunday afternoons called SB Rollers. As the sun hits its peak, dozens of guys and girls start rolling in. Someone in a truck drops off a couple amps that get plugged into a smartphone in the center of the pavement. Big is your mansion. Fresh out of school, now you working and focus on fashion. Pretty girl and you let go. Got time, but you got goals. Hey, baby, waste your time with me in California. People are decked out in 80s and 90s outfits like high-waisted booty shorts and brightly colored fanny packs. Others are covered in elbow and knee pads, their young kids in tow. Brown teaches a girl who drove up from L.A. with her parents how to moonwalk.
Nice. He goes all the rhythm. Feel the music. Go with it.
And as they jump, crisscross, and work on their moves, it's hard to ignore one fact. Terrence Brown is black, while all the other skaters in the club are white. A mostly white group isn't too surprising for Santa Barbara, which is mostly white residents. But Brown is doing something more than just skating around with his white neighbors. He's sharing a tradition of black skating. African Americans have spent decades developing a unique and vibrant skate culture. And as he learns to skate, he's learning about that history at the same time and starting to pass it on. KCRW's Catherine Barnes picks it up from here.
Brown works out for a living. The 31-year-old moved out to Santa Barbara from Miami 9 years ago to go to college and play football. He started a personal training business after he graduated. He specializes in getting athletes prepared for the college football and basketball seasons, and even trains some professional players. But his business started drying up at the beginning of spring when the pandemic set in here in California. So he called his mom back in Miami for some advice.
And I say, hey, this is really killing my business. You know, the clients wasn't coming. They were opting out, saying they wasn't coming back out. They didn't want to, you know, close contact. So I said, what should I do? And she goes, well, why don't you start skating? I'm like, no. I'm like, I have way too many muscles to be skating around. You know, I have way too many muscles. I'm like, I'm a football guy. I don't skate. So she goes, give it a try. She goes, I used to do it. You know, all my girlfriends and our afros, you know, it's fun. I'm telling you, you're going to love it.
She was right, as moms often are. He bought a pair of skates and was immediately hooked. And he's not alone. Try to order a pair of roller skates online, and you may be waiting until October. That's because there's been a resurgence of interest in roller skating lately. It's summer, streets are emptier, you've probably watched everything on Netflix. What else have you got to do? And there are all these viral videos going around of people roller skating, looking like they're having a lot more fun than you.
I actually went on YouTube, started looking up different videos of, you know, black people, you know, pretty much every culture, you know, doing it. But to see, you know, my kind, you know, African-American getting out there, getting outside of their element, because most of us, we grow up just doing sports, you know, outdoor sports. But to see someone in a roller rink, you know, a black person skating and having fun doing it and not being afraid to see people, you know, watch them fall. So I was like, I'm all in for it.
Brown didn't quite know it yet, but he was about to skate down a path laid out not only by his mom, but generations of black skaters. During the time of segregation, black people were kept out of rinks throughout the country, not just the South. In 1949, young protesters staged a skate-in at White City Roller Skating Rink in Chicago after black skaters were repeatedly denied entrance. Even after the civil rights era, many rinks would give black skaters just one evening a week, with a code name like Soul Night or Martin Luther King Night, letting them know which nights they were welcome. Rinks across the country also instated discriminatory dress codes and policies, like no baggy pants, no hip-hop music. Some of those kinds of rules still exist. The Moonlight Rollerway in Glendale prohibits hoodies worn over the head, and also micro-wheels, which are popular among black skaters because they're slicker and allow you to dance more easily. The rink says those rules are meant to keep people safe and aware of their surroundings, and that small wheels scuff up their original floor from the 1950s. But Pete Russell says none of the other rinks around LA have complained. He's a custom skate maker based in Paramount, east of Compton, and makes micro wheels at his shop.
You know, I can't tell another business owner how to run their business, but I mean, if you're going to do something that's going to specifically target, you know, a specific group of people, then there's really nothing else you can say other than that it's meant to keep those individuals out of your establishment.
Russell grew up skating in L.A. at those special nights catering to African-American clientele. He says they created a beautiful world filled with unique skate styles and burgeoning new music. In fact, many rap and hip-hop artists from the mid to late 80s started out performing at roller rinks. Dr. Dre, N.W.A., and Queen Latifah played some of their first shows at Skateland USA in Compton.
So, homeboy, check this out. His name is DJ Yella and he's in the place. Gonna rock the funky rhythm with the mouth and the bass. We came here to prove that we don't play as we go get busy with NWA. Now just throw your hands in the air.
Here's Cheryl James from Salt and Peppa in the 2018 HBO documentary United Skates.
Skating rings was hardcore. Like if you could rock out in a skating ring, then you know you're doing well.
Back in Santa Barbara, Terrence Brown is still learning about this history and how he plays a part in its future. But that future is complicated. Even before the pandemic, roller rinks have been closing all across the country. They simply don't make as much money as big box stores like a Home Depot. Skating outdoors, however, is having this renaissance. Russell says the amount of skates he's made and sold this past month would typically take him 3 months to get out the door. And with the rise of viral videos of predominantly white women showing off their dance moves on roller skates, longtime black skaters are worried a culture they helped create is getting whitewashed online. Here's one skater named Tony Nicole on TikTok.
When I look up roller skating on here, it's all white people. Skating is a huge part of the black community. Please follow black skaters.
Brown hasn't seen this type of tension come up in his own club, but he does have one example, the club's name itself.
You know, actually, before it was SB Rollers, it was Roll Bounce. And that's so funny, it had changed the name because no one knew about Roll Bounce.
Roll Bounce is a movie about a roller skating crew in 1970s Chicago, starring Bow Wow and Nick Cannon.
I want to say no one knew, none of my white friends. And most of them are pretty much have all white people in the group. And everyone was all, oh, what's Roll Bounce? What's Roll Bounce? And I was just, oh my God, I was so agitated. I'm like, okay, you know what? I'm just going to change the name to SB Rollers. And you know, of course they got that.
He says he's gotten negative feedback from his friends back in Miami for skating with a bunch of white people. But he says he wants the future of roller skating to be inclusive.
I'm not going to say, okay, you can't skate because you didn't build this. You know, you didn't create this foundation, you know, so that's what I'm doing too. I'm trying to teach and show people that you can actually bond with non-black people of a different color. And I'm like, it's way more fun to see the people, you know, outside of your own race doing what you can do and sometimes even better.
He tries to honor the history by playing old school soul, hip hop, reggae, and hits from, you guessed it, Roll Bounce. And pay it forward by promoting black skaters and black-owned skate businesses. And he welcomes everyone who stops by on Sundays. All ages, all colors, all abilities, all types of wheels. His t-shirt kind of says it best. Make America skate again. For KCRW, I'm Catherine Barnes.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW Donation Car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Jared Hill, in for Steve Chiatakis. A much-anticipated book is dropping today. It's about Stephen Miller, President Trump's senior advisor on immigration, who grew up right here in Santa Monica. Before leaving for vacation, Steve talked with the author of Hate Monger, the new book, Gene Guerrero. Here's that interview.
Santa Monica, the city on the LA County coast, conjures up images of the beach and the pier with the big Ferris wheel, shopping on 3rd Street Promenade, the setting for Three's Company, and the hometown of environmental activist, liberal activist, and actor Robert Redford. But it is also the hometown of the architect of some of President Donald Trump's harshest immigration policies. Stephen Miller grew up north of Montana Avenue, attended Samo High, where he became an antagonist to the area's liberal attitudes, and remains one of the select few White House aides who is still at the service of the president. Now, Trump's own racism and anti-immigrant rhetoric notwithstanding, those formative years of Miller's played an instrumental role in the nation's current political landscape. It is laid out in a new book called Hate Monger, Stephen Miller, Donald Trump, and the White Nationalist Agenda. It's from author Gene Guerrero, who's with me now. Hi, Gene.
Hey, Steve. Great to be here.
Nice to have you on. You're a former public radio reporter with our friends down at KPBS in San Diego. So you know how to walk a beat, right? And you know how to get a story, a narrative, and a place. What was it about Santa Monica and the area where Miller grew up? What did you learn while you were there?
Well, I saw Santa Monica as being a character in and of itself that really played a role in shaping who Stephen Miller became. You know, I grew up in Southern California, just a couple hours south of Santa Monica, during the same time period that Stephen Miller did, so in the 90s. And I remember, you know, that like at the time, there was a lot, despite Santa Monica being this very progressive bastion, statewide, there was a lot of anti-immigrant hostility during the 90s. There was, you know, Republican Governor Pete Wilson railing against the invasion and blaming all of the state's fiscal problems on migrants. And you also saw Prop 187, the tax on social services for children of the undocumented. You saw a tax on bilingual education and on affirmative action. And Stephen Miller really was a product of this environment. You know, from my reporting for the book, it was clear that he was listening to a lot of this statewide rhetoric. He was listening to Rush Limbaugh, you know, right-wing talk radio, and really internalizing these racist talking points that he was hearing during a very difficult time in his life. You know, from talking to people in his family and to his classmates, you know, it went right before Stephen Miller started high school. He was going through a period of turmoil where his father, who's a real estate investor, had, you know, he was tangled up in a bunch of legal disputes, and he had a bunch of bankruptcies, and he ends up losing a lot of money, and the family has to move from their house in north of Montana to a slightly more diverse part of Santa Monica.
Let's unpack a little bit about his upbringing. Because again, yeah, he moved from north of Montana over to the Pico neighborhood, right, in Santa Monica, farther to the east. Miller was listening to conservative AM talk radio while his friends, or maybe not his friends, other classmates at Samo High were listening to K-Rock or Kiss FM or maybe even KCRW. I mean, so he had Rush Limbaugh on all the time. He had Larry Elder on KABC. What drew him to those folks, and how did what they were talking about sort of mold his worldview?
Well, you know, from my conversations with people who knew Miller during this time of his life, he was really drawn to these like tough guy personas to sort of fill this void that you know, his father being busy and being tangled up in these legal disputes had left. And according to some of the family members that I spoke to, Stephen Miller was really kind of, it started out with him just trying to get his father's attention and acting out and finding comfort in these voices that he perceived to be like, you know, tough guys like Rush Limbaugh, who was railing against multiculturalism, feminazis, and basically, you know, just this real like white male grievance mentality that Stephen Miller, for some reason, identified with. Even though he's a Jewish American, he started to really identify as a white male. And you see him like really taking this to heart and like, you know, going around at Santa Monica High School, telling his Mexican classmates to speak English, to go back to their countries if they can't learn the American way, you know, going to school board meetings to argue against measures for improving racial equity. He grabbed onto this very hardcore right-wing ideology as a way of initially of getting attention, and you know, it slowly starts to become inseparable from his identity. And I really see Stephen Miller as a sort of a case study in radicalization. It's what happens when someone is exposed to an extremist ideology at a young age, at a vulnerable time in their lives, and is over time consumed by it. And in this case of Stephen Miller, ends up being the most powerful advisor in the White House, you know, implementing that extremist ideology. But another core component was simply that during this time in his life, while he was in Santa Monica, he met David Horowitz.
What kind of a force was David Horowitz? I mean, David Horowitz is in his 80s. I mean, Stephen Miller is 35. Like, how did Stephen Miller in high school get to know David Horowitz?
Well, it started with the fact that Stephen Miller was appearing on the Larry Elder Show, who was another one of his mentors, and, you know, complaining about his high school on the radio. And David Horowitz heard him, and he recalls finding Stephen Miller really gutsy for his rants against his school. And Stephen Miller ends up inviting David Horowitz to speak at the high school. And they developed this really long-lasting friendship and relationship where Horowitz, you know, helps him publish self-promotional articles on his website. He invites him over to his house to share ideas. And you know, he really fosters Stephen Miller's career over the course of many years. And he introduces him initially to this idea that, you know, that everything that we hold dear as Americans, from equality to freedom and other values that we have, that all of these things are a product of white men. You know, obviously that's ahistorical because it ignores the central role that people of color have played in our history. But Stephen Miller really bought into that idea and into this apocalyptic idea that David Horowitz was sharing, not only with Miller, but with all of his acolytes at the time, that, you know, that America was facing an existential threat and that it needed to be saved. And that existential threat was the Democratic Party because of its alliances with people of color. And so you see, you know, Stephen Miller being consumed by this mission that Horowitz introduces him to and staying in touch with Horowitz over the course of his time at Duke University. And Horowitz ends up getting him all of his jobs in Congress, you know, with Tea Party Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann, and later with Congressman John Shadegg of Arizona, and finally with Alabama Senator Jeff Sessions. So he really sets him up career-wise. And then when Stephen Miller joins the Trump campaign, David Horowitz was feeding him explosive talking points and policy ideas the entire time that you would see Trump adopting shortly afterward.
So Donald Trump becomes president, January 2017. I want you to read an excerpt from your book. It's the beginning of Chapter 11, titled American Carnage. This is Trump's inauguration speech.
Trump presented his inaugural address, which was classic Miller, with references to, quote, American carnage and, quote, rusted out factories scattered like tombstones. Trump promised, from this moment on, it's going to be America first. The Atlantic called the speech, quote, long on anger and dystopia. The Guardian said it cast a shadow. But Miller had long learned that there is value in outrage. The more upset the media was at his boss, or pretended to be, the better. They'd fixate on him, elevate him. As opponents grew numb, supporters grew strong.
That inauguration speech was very dark in tone, as many people mentioned. The worker has been forgotten. It drove home the point that this was the beginning of a new era. Here comes Trump to support that worker. Things are going to be different. There wasn't a whole lot of optimism, though, in it. And what you write in the book is that Miller saw value in that, value in keeping people angry. Is that what it was about?
Exactly, Steve. And that's why his relationship with Horowitz is so important. Horowitz had fed him a strategy paper while he was working for Sessions that cites the political utility of hatred and other hostile feelings and explicitly calls on the Republican Party to remake itself around demonization of its political opponents, painting the Democratic Party as evil incarnate and really trying to incite fear and other hostile emotions in response to one's political opponents. And so Stephen Miller really took this to heart in the way that he would shape Trump's rhetoric, inserting really apocalyptic language, as well as very gory, detailed descriptions of alleged migrant crimes. Everything from like talking about, you know, little girls being slaughtered, a migrant taking a hammer to crush a woman's eye sockets, just extremely gory stuff that Stephen Miller knew was going to incite hatred and fear in response. Not only to immigrants, as you mentioned, one of the key things that they did was paint the Democratic Party as a bunch of globalist elites intent on decimating America through the limitless importation of cheap labor through mass migration.
I want to go back to Santa Monica when he was in high school, because this was a pretty big moment for Miller at Samo High. You write about his relationship with a guy named Jason Islas. This was his friend. Probably close friend, his closest friend at that point, right?
Yeah, it was his best friend and one of his best friends in middle school.
In middle school, all right? And so Stephen Miller's sort of coming into his own, and he tells Jason Islas, I can't be your friend anymore. Explain that.
Yeah, Jason was struck by like the very, you know, matter-of-fact way that Stephen Miller gave him a call and told him, you know, I can't be your friend anymore because of your Latino heritage. And he also attacked a bunch of other things about Jason, told him he was too small and, you know, that he was insecure and just in a very deliberately cruel way. And you start to see Stephen Miller's cruelty show itself, like, as early as middle school.
And ergo, here we are, with some of these policies. I mean, people have written, there was, what was it, the Atlantic article whose title was The Cruelty is the Point, is sort of, you know, it's to defeat the other side in such a way that they can't get back up.
Yeah, it's really about crushing the enemy. This is the type of language that Stephen Miller learned from David Horowitz and you know, just going at them full speed. And when you look at what Stephen Miller has done with the immigration system in the United States, you know, Trump likes to paint his policies as being about targeting criminals and cartels. But Stephen Miller, who's in charge of his immigration policy, has been laser focused on targeting refugees and asylum seekers and other people fleeing violence and persecution in their home countries. And when you look at why he was doing this and where he was pulling these policies from, you see that it is very clearly a white nationalist agenda that he's pulling from think tanks that were created by a eugenicist who believed in population control for non-white people because he believed that non-white people posed an existential threat to America. And Stephen Miller had really internalized this idea from an early age. And so it's about re-engineering the ethnic flows into this country, but he has learned how to launder white nationalist and white supremacist ideas in the language of heritage and the language of economics and the language of national security in order to make it palatable to the mainstream.
Gene Guerrero, an investigative journalist and author of Hate Monger, Stephen Miller, Donald Trump, and the White Nationalist Agenda. It's out now, by the way. Gene, thanks.
Thank you so much.
And that's our show for today. Tomorrow, the Trump administration has decided to cut short the census by 1 month. What will that mean for big, hard-to-count urban areas like L.A.? Want to let you know that you can check us out on KCRW.com/GreaterLA. Share your thoughts with us and make sure to subscribe to the podcast while you're there. Once again, that's KCRW.com/GreaterLA. I want to thank the folks behind the curtain here. They are Jenna Cagle, Catherine Barnes, Sonia Geis, Amy Ta, Phil Richards, Chuck P., Mario Diaz, Desmond Taylor, Mario Saavedra, Christine Hermosissima, and Christian Bordal. I'm Jared Hill in for Steve Chiatakis. Have a great evening. We'll see you back here tomorrow.